A few weeks ago, before we started this summer sermon series, I preached for 2 weeks on the subject of joy. And the passage that we primarily looked at that time was the upper room discourse in John's Gospel. Jesus washes the disciples' feet in John chapter 13, and then he teaches them for three chapters, 14, 15, and 16. It's a lengthy discourse of Jesus speaking to his disciples. And he promises in that passage to send his disciples the Holy Spirit, what we call the advocate, or another word might be the comforter. Well, that's obviously going to help the disciples experience joy, to have this comforter with them. He then commends them to abide in him, remain in him always. Again, something that will help nurture joy. He promises to his disciples, in fact, that his joy will, not maybe, but will be made complete in them. John chapters 14, 15, and 16 is all about joy. And yet, it begins and ends with a completely different focus. John chapter 14, verse 1, "Do not let your hearts be troubled." The Greek word is terasso, stressing this inner turmoil. Something is being disturbed within a person, perhaps fear. And the discourse itself, John chapter 16, concludes with a promise, but again, the promise is focused on trouble. Jesus says, "I have told you all of these things over these past three lengthy chapters so that you may have shalom. In this world, you will have trouble." This time, the Greek word is phlipsis, emphasizing the sense of affliction that will be felt because you are a disciple of Jesus. Perhaps because you'll face persecution. Perhaps because of life-changing, challenging circumstances. Jesus is teaching then about joy. And that joy comes in the midst of trouble. In this world, you will have trouble. And yet his goal is that his joy will be made complete in us in amidst this trouble. How does that play out? How are we supposed to deal with that? Today we're looking at our third psalm in this series, Songs of Summer. Today, originally my sermon title was, I invited you to singing our fears. And then I realized I had misprinted it in the little bulletin and on the website, and I'd actually written, singing our tears. The funny thing is, the psalm we're looking at today covers both of those. It's about singing our tears, it's about singing our fears, it's about singing our trouble. And so I purposely printed out these little handouts with a few questions on them for you to think about, because perhaps you're already thinking about those questions. And I invite you, think through those questions later at home during a quiet time. Think through those questions this week as you continue to sing this psalm, because hopefully those questions will help each of us enter into the world of this psalmist, the world of the person who put this incredible song together. Psalm chapter 6. It opens with a heading for the director of music, "With stringed instruments according to Sheminith, a psalm of David." Lord, do not rebuke me in your anger or discipline me in your wrath. Have mercy on me, Lord, for I am faint. Heal me, Lord, for my bones are in agony. My soul is in deep anguish. How long, Lord? How long? return, Lord, and deliver me. Save me because of your unfailing love. Among the dead, no one proclaims your name who praises you from the grave. I am worn out from my groaning. All night long I flood my bed with weeping and drench my couch with tears. My eyes grow weak with sorrow. They fail because of all my foes. Away from me, all you who do evil, for the Lord has heard my weeping. The Lord has heard my cry for mercy. The Lord accepts my prayer. All my enemies will be overwhelmed with shame and anguish. They will turn back and suddenly be put to shame. Well, can you hear the trouble that David is facing in this psalm? King David, who at other times throughout his reign as king of Israel, is so full of the joy of the Lord. And in here he's speaking about enemies, those that are doing evil against him. He's clearly greatly troubled by fear, fear of those around him. Well, God asked, well, why? Why are these people? Who are these people? What are they doing to David at this particular time? And yet David also speaks of a deep distress that has befallen him, that he's feeling and experiencing so much so he's weeping profusely through the night. He's groaning. He's weary from this groaning, and he's drenching his bed with tears. What's causing these anguish cries of a king? Further, he's singing about his trouble to God and begins by appealing to God, God, don't rebuke me or discipline me out of your anger. What has David done that would make him make such a request? Like, why would God be angry with David? And David's not asking God not to rebuke him, full stop, but not to rebuke him out of his anger or wrath. So why? What has happened that causes this part of this trouble? And one more thing that goes on. In this psalm, David speaks about his bones being very weak. He's extremely faint. He's weary. He's talking about death as if it's looming close. Is David on his deathbed right here in this psalm? Does David sing this psalm when he comes right to the end of his life? See, no one really knows. No one knows the actual situation, or should I say situations, that have occurred, that have come together in this prayer. You see, it looks like this prayer covers a wide range of trouble, situations, times in David's life. The psalm is just full of trouble, every kind of trouble that David has faced, is facing, or perhaps will face very soon. See, let's think about two of these times of trouble briefly. Remember David's little sinful act with Bathsheba. 2 Samuel chapter 11, David's up on the roof of his palace. He's gazing up at the night sky, up at the stars, and lo and behold, he sees a beautiful woman bathing on a nearby rooftop. David's the king, and so he decides, as is his wont as king, well, I want her. So he sends for her, he has his wicked way with her, and she falls pregnant. But she's married to Uriah the Hittite. What's David going to do? Well, he tries his best to cover up this mess, but he can't. And so he goes to the last resort. He sends Uriah to the front line of his army and has Uriah killed in battle. So then David can take Bathsheba to be his wife. Everybody lives happily ever after, or so he thinks. He's gotten away with it, this little dastardly deed. But God is not one bit pleased. So God sends Nathan the prophet, and they have a bit of a community to rebuke David. And they have a bit of a conversation, and lo and behold, judgment is pronounced on David. for his sin. But that judgment doesn't fall on David per se, but on David's son, born of Bathsheba. Did David sing this psalm as he pleaded with God for mercy for his sin against God, against Uriah, against Bathsheba? Did David weep night after night after night, praying to God that God would spare his son, this little baby boy? Did David's fasting that we're told about make him so physically and emotionally weary that David sings this psalm at the weakest time in his life? It was as if he was dying, just like his son was about to die. Did David sing Psalm 6 at that time in his life when he kind of knew deep down God was teaching him a lesson? Lord, don't rebuke me in your anger or discipline me in your wrath, even though you have the right to do so because of the wrongs that I have done. David knows the sin he's committed against God, Bathsheba, and Uriah. Did David sing these words because of the deep guilt and shame that was overcoming him? And so he pleads to God for mercy, knowing full well he doesn't deserve it. He deserved to be treated by God the way that David had treated Uriah. David sings about trouble, a lot of trouble, because of the mess that he's made of his life and others because of his lust for Bathsheba. Did he sing it at that time? Well, who knows, maybe. Or maybe David sings it later when one of his own sons, called Absalom, seeks to overthrow the king. 2 Samuel chapter 17, we're told that Ahithophel said to Absalom, I would choose 12,000 men and set out tonight in pursuit of your father, David. I would attack him when he is weary and when he's weak. And then I would strike him with terror, and then all the people with him will flee. I would strike down the king, your father, and bring all the people back to you. The death of the man you seek will mean the return of all the people will be unharmed. This plan seemed good to Absalom and to all the elders of Israel. But Absalom said, well, let's get a second opinion. Summon Hushai the Archite so we can hear what he has to say as well. When Hushai came to him, Absalom said, Ahithophel has given this advice. Should we do what he says? If not, give me your opinion. Hushai replied to Absalom, well, the advice that he's given is not good. So this I advise you, that all of Israel from Dan in the north to Beersheba in the south, as numerous as the sand on the seashore, be gathered to you, Absalom, with you yourself leading them into battle. Then we will attack the king, your father David, wherever he may be found, and we will fall on him as dew settles on the ground. Neither he nor any of his men will be left alive. Absalom and all the men of Israel said, this advice is much better than the previous. Anyway, the story continues. Absalom takes the advice, rallies all the troops to fight and overthrow his father, King David. But David knows he's coming. He knows he's coming. Did David sing Psalm 6 in the face of what was approaching? His own son wanting to overthrow him. But God intervenes. And Absalom, it's a kind of a comedy, ends up hanging by his own hair. Guys, cut your hair short. He gets caught in a tree. So Absalom is dangling from this tree, hanging from his hair, and one of David's generals hears about it, goes out and thrusts a javelin into Absalom and kills him. Well, David's about to be overthrown, and now the enemy, his dad, his own son is dead. How will David respond to this? 2 Samuel 18, the king was shaken. The word, troubled. The king was deeply troubled. So what did he do? We're told he went up to his room over the gateway and he wept. As he went, he said, "Oh, my son Absalom, if only I had died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son." Did David compose Psalm 6 at this point when he's now crying and weeping over the death of his own son? We don't know. But David is so troubled, or reflecting on so much trouble that he has faced, he sings this particular song. It is a song based of a man at the lowest point in his life. Doesn't it be one of those strange aspects in the Psalms that it starts with that heading, a lengthy heading for the director of music, right? Jen, this is instructions for you. You've to play this with stringed instruments according to Sheminith. To which point Jen would reply and go, "I think you've spelt a word wrong. Because I have no clue what Sheminith is. And nobody does, except for Professor Long. Ask him later." David writes this song and he gives instructions about how it should be played, how it should be sung, what instruments, what rhythm. According to Sheminith, well, what does it mean? Literally, it means an eighth. So it could mean an octave. Could refer to a particular note within that octave. This is the first note Alana needs to hit on the piano and go from there. I was particularly intrigued by one interpreter suggesting that this note is the lowest note that a male voice can sing. Does Psalm 6 sing from the lowest point in a person's life? When we feel God is punishing us, deservedly so, because of things we've done? Or is God testing us and we know it might hurt, but he's strengthening our faith somehow? Do we sing this when we feel that God is distant from us and we plead that he will return? Do we sing when we're sick, when we're so lonely that we've only got our shadow as company? When we face trials and temptations, when we're experiencing death of a loved one? When we are literally surrounded by an enemy. One day we wake up and life is just fine. Fine and dandy. All of a sudden this enemy appears. Perhaps of the cancerous type. And now we're trapped. And all we can do is wait for the next attack that will come time after time after time. That will eventually kill us. People experience trouble. We all do. And when serious trouble hits, we're at the lowest point in our lives. What can we do about it? Psalm 6 sings about these times. Even though David's name's at the top of this psalm, we could associate it with so many other people. Job could have written this psalm. Jonah could have sung these words from the belly of the whale, or perhaps Hannah. Wow, remember her trouble. 1 Samuel 1. Whenever the day came for Elkanah to sacrifice, he would give portions of the meat to his wife, Peninnah, and to all her sons and all her daughters. But to Hannah, he gave a double portion because he loved her. But God had closed her womb. Because the Lord had closed Hannah's womb, her rival kept provoking her in order to irritate her. This went on year after year after year. Whenever Hannah went up to the house of the Lord, her rival provoked her till she wept and wept and wept and would not eat. Her husband, Elkanah, would say to her, "Hannah, why are you weeping? Why don't you eat? Why are you just so downhearted? Don't I mean more to you than 10 sons?" As if Hannah's not facing enough trouble, her husband is a complete idiot. "Hannah, who cares that you don't have any kids? You have me." What an idiot. He doesn't experience the instinct of becoming a mother that is being snatched away from her month after month after month for year after year after year. Did Hannah sing Psalm 6? Perhaps Elijah did. Elijah had one of those mountaintop experiences where he kind of took on the prophets of Baal. Everything went really kind of fine and dandy. He was singing a song of praise. And then we're told, now Ahab told his wife Jezebel everything that Elijah had done and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. And so Jezebel sends a messenger to Elijah and says to him, "May the gods deal with me, be it ever so severely, if by this time tomorrow I do not make your life like that of one of my prophets." Elijah's just taking on all the prophets. This is the point where Elijah should have sent a messenger, you know, back and said, "Bring it on." You know. But no, the very next thing we read is Elijah was so afraid he ran for his life. And the next time he shows up, he's in a cave. Perhaps not a physical cave, but a virtual cave, because he is so deeply depressed. He came to a broom bush, sat down under it, and prayed that he might die. "Lord, I've had enough. Take my life." Can you see how so many people in the Bible could have so easily sung the words of Psalm 6? And if we were to look around right now, there are literally so many people here who face troubles every day. Trouble that would lead them to do what the psalmist did, weep and weep until their bed is saturated with tears. So when you come to Psalm 6, the big question then should be, why sing it? Or how does singing it somehow help the trouble? Does it help? Well, I believe it does. You see, because amidst the trouble, whatever the trouble is, one thing comes back into focus, and the entire psalm is hinged on what the psalmist sees: God's unfailing love. We saw it last week in Psalm 103. This love that the psalmist is talking about or singing about, it's not just a tender care. The word is hesed. It's a love that's unconditional, a love that's unwavering, and most importantly of all, a love that is loyal. In other words, it's a promise. God has promised he will keep you forever. That's the heart of this psalm. In the midst of everything that surrounds this psalmist, or has done, is doing, or ever will do, the psalmist focuses on God's hesed, which totally transforms his experience. No matter what the trouble is, God's hesed can be claimed for himself, for herself, amidst the trouble. And so the psalmist ends with three statements that build on one another, that build to this absolute certainty. My life is held in God's hands. For the Lord has heard my weeping. The Lord has heard my cry for mercy. The Lord accepts my prayer. Literally, the Lord has taken ownership of my prayer. My prayer is now owned by the living God, and he will act upon it because of his hesed love for me. And so the prayer apparently ends with David. Just like that, everything's okay. Is that what we're to learn from the psalm? Read the psalm once, think about hesed, bang, trouble's gone. Believing in the hesed is one thing. But how does believing in it somehow transform the psalmist's experience in the face of his trouble? And the answer is by singing it. Very specific instructions. This is how this psalm should be sung. We're encouraged to sing it and sing it and sing it and sing it over and over and over in the face of trouble. The more you sing, the more times of trouble that you will remember, the more you will focus on God's hesed love, and the more that trouble will somehow disappear. There's a story in Acts chapter 16 of Paul and Silas in the jail in Philippi. They've been beaten with rods severely, and we see them now chained and secured in stocks. They've had a pretty crummy day. They're clearly experiencing a horrendous trouble. So what do? They sing. Verse 25, about midnight, Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns to God, and the other prisoners were listening. Amidst the trouble, they were singing, and it made all the difference for them. Why? Because as they sang, there was only one thing that they could focus on. When we sing, there's nothing else we can focus on. Our attention turns to what we are singing about, who we are singing to. Praise to God. And that's what Psalm 6 is encouraging us to do. Sing our trouble to God. So what do, Martin? Sing this 10 times and all of a sudden the enemy will disappear. Sing it 10 times and all what we're praying for will be taken away. No. Don't hear that the wrong way. The psalmist is not promising that the trouble will just disappear. The experience within the trouble will dramatically change. Isn't that what Jesus was teaching in John chapter 14 to 16? You will face trouble. I'm not promising that you won't, says Jesus. You will, but amidst the trouble, I'm sending you the Spirit because my joy will be made complete in you. In the midst of the trouble, trust in God's hesed love. Focus on his love, and his joy will be made complete in you. And so this morning, I leave you with these words to encourage you, all of us. Last week we sang a song by Matt Redmond. It's a song called 10,000 Reasons. As I was looking and researching and praying and writing this week, I kept hearing these words over and over and over again. And so we're going to close this time by singing these words. Bless the Lord, O my soul, O my soul. Worship his holy name. Sing like never before, O my soul. I'll worship your holy name. The sun comes up. It's a new day dawning. It's time to sing your song again. Because whatever may pass, whatever lies before me, let me be singing when the evening comes. Bless the Lord, O my soul, O my soul. I'll worship your holy name. Let's sing together.